Welcome to the Fit Chicks Chat Podcast, where we talk all things fitness, nutrition, and wellness for women to help you live your healthiest and fiercest life inside and out. And now, your hosts, Laura Jackson and Amanda Quinn.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's episode of Fit Chicks Chat. I'm Laura Jackson, and I'm super excited to have a very special guest with us today, the amazing Corey Rabi from Radical Health. Hello, Corey.
Hey.
So Corey is not only a certified nutritional practitioner, I know her personally. Actually, I've taken courses with her, and she's fabulous. But she's also a herbalist, and my favorite thing of all that she is she's a fermentation queen. So that is what we're here actually to be talking about today, is about fermentation and essentially creating your own probiotic foods, which for all my nerdy chicks out there, you already know how much I love talking about fermentation. So Corey, I'd love to start off though, before we get into obviously all of that meaty stuff, just talking about, you know, who you are, your journey into this industry, how you even got interested in fermentation.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm Corey. And, what got me into eating well and health is that I was a really unhealthy child. Like, I had the standard North American diet. I ate crap. You know, I grew up in the 80s. It was all like TV dinners and Domino's pizza. And I was chubby as a child, and I was really sick. Like, I was sick pretty much all the time from when I was about 13 to about 16.
Oh,
I had chronic strep throat. I had asthma. I had bronchitis. I had tonsillitis constantly. They removed my tonsils. And I just kept getting sick and sick. And at one point, I don't know where this book came from, but this book fell into my lap. It was called Food is a Wonder Medicine by Dr. Neil Bernard. And it's actually a vegan book, but it was all about eating healthy and what an impact this can have on your body. And in it, he says, you know, just try it. Just try it for like 4 weeks, 6 weeks and see what it does. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to follow this diet plan. And so I was about 18 when I did this, and I started following the plan. And at first I got really sick, actually, because I didn't know what was happening. Like, I was sneezy, I had rashes, but I realized now my body was actually detoxing from years of eating like crap. And then, you know, around week three, I just started feeling amazing. And a week four, I felt even better, and I just kept going with it. So what started off as a 4 week experiment turned into the rest of my life, basically. And ever since doing that, switching over to a healthy diet, my health has just continued to improve. Like, I haven't had an antibiotic in over 20 years.
Yay!
I actually cured my own asthma and allergies, and I used to be like, react to everything so badly. I would have to lie on the couch and stuff Kleenex up my nose. It was like, and take antihistamines, and even that wouldn't stop it. But I've cured my allergies, and I don't even need to use asthma inhalers anymore. So I have seen the power. It is. I have seen the power of what eating healthy can do in my own life. And I just want to help other people get to the root of their issues and figure out how they can live a healthier life that's not dependent on medications and, you know, visiting the doctor all the time, because that's not a way to live.
No, and that's one thing I've always loved about you. So for anyone listening, I met Corey in person. I've seen her educate. I've seen her teach. And you just come from such a place of like rawness, and the tools you give, they're so like usable. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't make it scary. Because I think a lot of people out there, when they're thinking about transitioning their diet and their lifestyle, it's really overwhelming. You know what I mean? Like, it becomes like, it feels like more of a job than it is something that is exciting or enjoyable. So like, I just always love the way you approach stuff. And I just think that you are such a gift to this.
Thank you.
No, I'm like, I girl crush on Corey, especially because whenever we talk about fermentation.
Yeah.
Okay. So then I want to kind of like sideways into, this is how you got into this industry, but then how did you start with your passion for fermentation? Because it's not something you kind of wake up and say, oh my gosh, I love fermenting.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's kind of weird. I guess I actually got into fermentation because I'm a really bad gardener.
Oh my God, maybe that's why I'm into it too, because I am as well.
So I was like, I want to grow a garden. And I had no idea what I was doing. And I thought, ooh, 6 zucchini plants, that's sufficient for 2 people. And so if you've ever grown zucchini, you know, like that's an insane amount. You need like 1 zucchini plant. So I would end up with like, you know, all these zucchinis or
they
all
grow like crazy.
Yeah. Or all this squash or, you know, and eating close to land has always been important to me. So I wanted to figure out how to preserve the harvest into winter because, you know, we're in Canada and we have such long winters, it's hard to get local food. So that led me down to the path of preservation. So I learned how to can food, I learned how to dehydrate, and naturally that led to fermentation. And so at the time where I was in Ottawa, no one was teaching it. There were no courses. There wasn't a lot of information online even. So I sort of asked around and I was able to learn how to make sourdough from one person I knew and how to make sauerkraut from another person and how to make kombucha from another person. And I sort of just started experimenting in it and doing it. And then I started noticing how much better it made me feel. And that sort of led me down the avenue of investigating what is in fermented foods that makes me feel so good. And so I mean, that's how the journey started. Just started off by me out of necessity of wanting to preserve my food, which is why traditionally people fermented in the first place was food preservation. They had no idea that there were these invisible, or maybe they did, but invisible microscopic organisms that were, you know, helping their digestive system and the rest of their body. They did it out of, you know, necessity.
Well, that's what I find. So for anyone who's listening to this and you've never fermented before, like, or you're afraid to ferment, we're going to talk about how to do that and get over those fears. Cause you were the person, Corey, that actually, like, I remember in class talking to you and being like, I have this fear of my fermented food, not fermenting, but rotting. Cause there's a big difference between going moldy and actually fermenting. Right. So I remember you just saying, you know what, just go with it. If it goes moldy, who cares? Like, throw it out, throw it again. And it was like that feeling of, cause there is, I don't know why it's weird. There's some for, well, maybe just for me, but there is this kind of nerves around, I find, doing it for the first time. So let's jump in then.
Okay.
For those who don't really know. So, okay, what exactly is fermentation?
Well, in the context that we're speaking about, it's the transformation of food by microscopic organisms. So that's bacteria and yeast, basically. Yeah. And so there's two, it happens. So fermentation, not to get too sciencey, but it happens in an anaerobic environment when the bacteria and yeast are lacking oxygen. They'll start fermenting to produce energy, a type of energy called ATP. People, you know, you may have heard of ATP, but anyway. So when they do that, they're creating energy, they create byproducts. So one of those, it could either go two ways. One of those ways is they produce alcohol. So we have alcohol ferments like, you know, wine and beer and liquor. And then we have lactic acid ferments because that byproduct, the byproduct they're producing in the fermentation process is lactic acid.
So question there for you, mm-hmm. Which I think a lot of people don't even realize that all alcohols are fermented products, mm-hmm. but is there a different bacteria that's used for each of those?
Yeah. So some types of bacteria and yeast, more so yeast with alcohol fermentation, will create alcohol and some will go the lactic acid route.
Oh.
So lactobacillus bacteria tend to produce lactic acid over alcohol. Where certain types of yeast, like Saccharomyces cerevisiae, will produce alcohol.
I always remember that one because cerevisiae, I always think of cervezas from Mexico.
Exactly. And that's where it comes from. Yeah.
Which, see, like, I'm such a nerd. I find this stuff so cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's no air, there's no oxygen. These little bugs start to produce byproducts.
Mm-hmm.
That then, so then what happens to whatever, let's say, let's use the example of, let's say we're using sauerkraut, which is cabbage.
Yeah. At first. So the bacteria in the sauerkraut will start producing lactic acid, and lactic acid will lower the pH. And so that creates an environment that's inhospitable to bad bacteria. So that's why you don't have to worry. That's why things don't go moldy and rot. It's because the lactic acid is lowering the pH, where only good bacteria survive and the bad bacteria don't grow.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, okay. So after that's happened though, the one thing I've always found really fascinating is, like, how does the food's nutritional profile change? So we have the cabbage, right? Like, it starts off being cabbage, and then suddenly we ferment it and all of the bad bacteria can't grow, and we're producing this good more of this good bacteria. How does that actually change the nutrition of this cabbage now? Like, is it the same? Is it different?
Yeah. So it does increase the nutrition of the cabbage in the case of sauerkraut. It's different for different ferments, but we'll take sauerkraut for an example. So with sauerkraut, when you ferment it, it actually increases the vitamin C drastically. And I haven't seen a good research study saying the exact amount, but I've read it increases the vitamin C up to 20 times from a decent source. Yeah. So, and not only does it increase it, the way it increases it, it makes it more bioavailable. So the bacteria will break down the cellulose in the cabbage and other constituents in the cabbage, so your body is able to absorb it better. So your body will absorb the vitamin C better, for instance. And, you know, the same thing happens in other types of ferments. So with sourdough bread,
yeah,
break down what's called phytates. Phytates are sort of known as an anti-nutrient. They're in a lot of foods, and they help, they prevent your body from absorbing certain nutrients. So when you ferment sourdough, it breaks down the phytate in the wheat, and then your body's better to able to absorb all the B vitamins in the sourdough, particularly folate. So yeah, so it will improve the absorption of certain nutrients in the body. And it also, a lot of fermented foods have enzymes that help you digest those nutrients.
And that's why it's so, you gave the example of sourdough and you gave the example of sauerkraut. So pretty much though, you can ferment anything, right? Like any plants?
Yeah, you could basically ferment all kinds of vegetables and fruit. Like I ferment, I mean, I'm a little weird. So I ferment, wild edibles. Like I ferment dandelion greens that I get out of my front yard, and like Japanese knotweed. But once you know the technique and the science, and you've done it a couple times and you're really comfortable with the process, you could really turn the science to an art and incorporate all sorts of vegetables into it. Cabbage is traditionally used because it's easy to ferment. It's a very cheap vegetable. Like you could buy a cabbage and it's very low cost. It ferments really well. You could ferment pretty much any fruit or vegetable, but it doesn't necessarily mean you want to, because certain fruits and vegetables, when they ferment, the texture changes or the flavor changes. Some get really bitter, some get really soft, and it just becomes unpalatable. It doesn't mean it's unsafe. It's just kind of gross to eat. Yeah.
So, well, that's the one thing I think is so cool about this. Like, and I always find that the more people actually try, and once you get into fermentation and you are creating your own probiotic foods, essentially, it's like, it's the coolest thing, and it connects you back to the earth, right? Like it connects us back to our food and like the bacteria and the whole process of it. Like for me, I absolutely love it. And I'm teaching my nieces how to do this, like kids, and so, like, well, they're 10. I guess they just turned 11. But kids love this kind of stuff because it's also, you're teaching them about science, but at the same time, like, you're reconnecting them to the whole process of like creating food.
Yeah, exactly. And they get to watch something change.
Yeah.
Like, because a ferment will literally, in the first week, it will change day to day, but it transforms over time, and they find it fascinating watching that transformation. So do I.
No, me too. I actually was just in Spain, and we went to Cava country. So Cava is essentially, it's like champagne. It's like bubbly wine. But the thing, we did a whole tour, and it was like a small Cava winery. And the thing I loved the most was when he went through the whole double fermentation process. So he showed how they fermented the initial wine, and then to make it bubbly, how they did the second fermentation. And that for me just gave me, you know, I do love me some wine and I do love me some bubbles, but that gave me a whole new like appreciation for it, because you actually saw the work that like these ferments sometimes took up to 3 years to get them to where they wanted to be. And inside that bottle, like there's a whole, all these organisms, there's a whole world going on in there that's creating these bubbles. And I just found that now when I drink cava, I have a whole different appreciation for it. Like it's so cool.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely does connect you to the earth in a number of ways. I mean, the first is sourcing the vegetables, and getting them. And, you know, ideally you want to get nice organic local veggies to make your ferments in. And the reason is the fermentation process starts by the bacteria that's on those vegetables on the outside of the leaves and sort of in the cabbage leaves. And so if you have like a nice organic vegetable, like it's going to have a different bacterial profile than the ones at the grocery store.
Oh, I love that tip. Yeah. I never even actually thought about that.
I mean, the ones at the grocery store will still work and it still tastes great, but you know, you'll get different flavor profiles with different cabbages, different seasons of the different seasons of when you get the cabbage, the other things you add into them. I mean, it connects you to the earth that way, but also because you're living with these living microscopic things, there's the things like temperature and air pressure, like they all affect them.
Well, and that's what I remember speaking with you about before, is like your ferments, how different they are when you're fermenting in the winter versus the summer, just even from the temperature, the natural temperature in your house, like how it changes the profile.
So there's all these variables, and it will put you in touch more with what's going on around you.
Yeah.
Because you're thinking like, how is this going to affect my ferment? And it also puts you more in touch with the food and how it's reacting to the things like temperature and humidity.
Cool. Well,
particularly sourdough. Sourdough is really reactive to the weather.
I haven't done that yet. And my mom does her own kombucha. It's delicious. I told her, I'm like, you should open like your own line of kombucha. She has her own kombucha and she does kefir, but and she makes her own yogurt, but we were looking at, we need to get some starter culture for the sourdough. And one of her clients, she said that she has some. So I'm going to wait till she gets it and we're going to make some sourdough.
Cool. Yay.
But I just think, just going on what you just said, I think it's so crazy how our world right now, like we're so afraid of bacteria. Like we're still in this mindset that bacteria is bad, right? Mm. Like hand sanitizers. And so a lot of people, I think when they hear fermentation and we start talking about bacteria, it's like, it puts them off. But when really bacteria, like we are full of bacteria, right?
We're actually covered in bacteria inside and out. They line our whole body. They're in our eyes. They're in our mouth. They're in our lungs. So we actually exchange bacteria with the air all the time. And one fascinating thing I just sort of read and thought about was, you know, in the old days when people were sick, they would send them to the mountains or the oceans to get air. Right. And usually when people had lung disorders, it was because they had too much bad bacteria. Right. Right, tuberculosis or whatever, these infections. So they would send them to the mountains to get air or the sea to get air. And I was thinking how and I haven't read any science about this, but how like the bacteria profiles in that air are different. There's probably more beneficial bacteria in the air, or it's richer in beneficial bacteria than in the cities. So they would send them to the mountains to actually breathe in the air and get these good bacteria back in their lungs to help decrease the amount of bad bacteria.
Well, and I even think about even how amazing I feel living. I've lived in the mountains. I lived in Banff, Alberta for 4 years or going by the water. And I read a study years ago, just even talking about stress levels and our natural rhythms and how being by mountains or by water reduces that and evens out your body's natural rhythm by like, I can't remember the percentage, but I always have felt different when I'm in those elements. So
I think the bacteria are one factor in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's where as we get into talking about, you know, why it's so good for your health to eat fermented foods. I think it's just important for people to understand that, like you were saying, bacteria is good. And it's just the balance, though, of the good bacteria and the bad bacteria. The issue with a lot of people is they just have too much of the bad.
Yeah, right? It's just a population game, really.
Yeah.
And a diversity game. So those are the two factors that are really important, is how much good bacteria do you have versus bad bacteria, and the diversity and the different types. And it's also, you know, people think like, oh, I should have no bad bacteria, but bad bacteria actually in certain numbers perform very important functions in the body.
Mm-hmm.
So we need a little bit of, H. pylori, which is the bacteria that can cause stomach ulcers when the number is too high, but in small amounts, H. pylori has a lot of important functions. So it's just a matter of keeping that right balance and having the diversity in there. And the sad thing is, with modern antibiotics and chemicals in our food, we've decreased the amount of bacteria in our body as well as the diversity. And there's some strains, once you lose them in your body, they're gone forever. Like, you can't get them back.
That makes me sad.
I know. That doesn't mean you can't do things to, you know, help your body along, but it's just, diversity is key. And that's why it's really important to expose babies and children in early ages to different things, like things like soil and pets and people.
Yeah.
So they get these diverse microbes, these microbes from different sources in their body.
Well, and that's one thing. I mean, I think that being in this industry, and you and I are both certified nutritional practitioners on a holistic side. Mm-hmm. And I think we understand that. And it's sometimes, I don't know for you, it's frustrating for me when I just see how people are so afraid, especially with children, to expose them. Like, it's like, this bacteria is a bad thing, the world is a bad thing. I'm like, that's how they're building their immune system.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, there are some things you don't want your children to be touching. Like, you know, I used to pick up dog poop when I was a kid, which is probably not the best thing.
Yeah.
My mom would see me on the beach and she'd think I'm picking up like a rock and I'm trying to put it in my mouth. And she's like, but like, those things happen. But during that, when you're young, that's when you're building your immune system and you need exposure, or else you're going to get sicker later on. So, you know, I think that's why I love talking about things like this, because I think it pulls back the curtain a little bit on all of these myths, in a sense, that are being promoted. You know, like, I find a lot of products that are being pushed, they're pushed based on one study or one way of thinking, but they're not looking at the bigger picture. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, we've been made to fear bacteria for ages.
Yeah.
And it's only up until recently where all this new research has come out that we're realizing the benefits of good bacteria and the detrimental effects that this whole, everything needs to be sterile, everything needs to be certain,
no,
super clean, like the effect that that's having on our good bacteria. And people, you know, and this has been going on for a couple generations now, so it's really kind of reached a crisis level, I think, where people's bacteria are so out of whack. And because your gut health and bacteria are linked to everything in your body, all conditions, from metabolism to hormones to cardiovascular health to your mental health, we're seeing issues in all these areas just rise. And it all comes down to the balance of bacteria. I mean, of course, there's other factors. I think stress is another huge, huge issue.
But stress also wipes out good bacteria.
Exactly. So. And having too much bad bacteria increases the level of stress. Cortisol in your body. So, you know, it again, it's that interface between like your mind and your body, as well as the environment.
Okay, so let's talk about some positive stuff then. So why is these fermented foods? So by eating these fermented foods, we're going to get more good bacteria. So why is it so good for your health to eat fermented foods? Well, I guess I kind of answered my question in a sense.
Well, yeah, but I can elaborate on it. So fermented foods, not only the fermentation process, as we already talked about, first of all, increases the vitamin content or the ability of the body to, or the absorption of certain nutrients. So they're more nutritious. So cabbage has more vitamin C, sourdough has more vitamin B. Also, just to go back to sourdough, fermentation will also often decrease nutrients that are hard for, or constituents of foods that are hard for us to digest. So when you ferment sourdough, for instance, it actually changes the structure of the gluten so your body can better absorb that molecule. And what's interesting, a lot of people who have trouble eating regular wheat can, or regular bread, can eat sourdough. And I've worked with lots of people who can't eat regular bread but can eat sourdough just fine. And that's because the bacteria have transformed it and the gut can now handle it. Yeah, I'm sort of going off topic here, but when you have trouble digesting something, like you have trouble digesting wheat or trouble digesting dairy or trouble digesting beans, it's actually a symptom. It's not the food's fault. It's a symptom. And it just means that you don't have the right bacteria in your gut to digest those foods. So I could digest wheat just fine because I have the right bacteria. But someone who can't, they need to do it externally. So they need to make the sourdough bread so those bacteria make the gluten into a form that they can digest. Or they need to have yogurt or kefir instead of milk, because the yogurt and kefir bacteria have converted the lactose in a form that their body can absorb. Right. And then
so fascinating.
Yeah. And then like, oh, so you don't have those bacteria to do it in your body. You don't have those residential bacteria, but you can kind of introduce them in a transitory nature. So they'll go through your body and then over time they'll build up and they'll work with the residential gut bacteria and change the profile. And now I'm going off topic and forgetting what the original question was.
But I think all this stuff is so good. And before we keep going about like the health benefits of it, I just like to give, we've given the example of sauerkraut. We've given the example of sourdough. What are some other examples though of fermented foods that people would see in their grocery stores or that they could buy before they even want to make them?
Yeah, well, so first of all, there's a lot of foods we're already eating a lot of fermented foods. One fermented food that people drink every morning is coffee, right? Yes. So coffee is actually fermented for a short period of time, but it doesn't have any of the health benefits of the probiotics. So a lot of the things we eat have been fermented for a short period of time just to change their flavor. Mm-hmm. So those are examples of fermented foods, actually. But in terms of beneficial fermented foods, ones that you can easily pick up at a grocery store, one of the best ones out there for you is milk kefir.
Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that now. You know, before you used to have to go to a health food store, and now you can see it in your day-to-day grocery store in the yogurt section.
Yeah, but the brand is actually important, the type of kefir you buy, because the type of yogurt as well, because a lot of a common practice in a lot of companies is to ferment the yogurt, ferment the kefir, even kombucha, ferment it, pasteurize it, so they kill off all those bacteria, and then they add bacteria back in.
Yes.
Because when you're producing something commercially, you need to be able to do it at a level that where the product is consistent, where in the case of ferments, because a byproduct is carbon dioxide, they don't want things, they want to know how much carbon dioxide it will produce in a certain period of time so things don't explode. So brand is important. So in Canada, we have the Liberté organic kefir. I know that that is a good brand of kefir.
That's actually my favorite one.
That's a really good one to get. I mean, most of the yogurts in the store, unfortunately, have been pasteurized with the probiotics added back in. But if you are just starting out, I still think like a good organic yogurt is a good place to go. Yeah. In some grocery stores, you can get things like kimchi and sauerkraut. And the important thing is to make sure that you look for those in the refrigerator. If they're on the shelf, they've been pasteurized and all the good bacteria have died off.
And then on the label too, because I know that's one question that I get. Mm-hmm. If you're buying it, you know, in the sauerkraut that we grew up on, if you're not Eastern European and your grandmother made it or your parents made it, typically people think, oh, sauerkraut's so disgusting, because they think about that wine flavored, you know, sauerkraut in a can that you get like in the pickle aisle. And so that stuff is not good.
No, it doesn't have the benefits of the beneficial bacteria. Like you still are getting the benefits of the cabbage in it. So I'm not going to say that it's bad for you, but if you're looking for probiotics, it's not where you're going to find them.
So when you're looking on the label, you essentially just want like cabbage and salt or...
Yeah.
Because vinegar, and this is a question I actually had for you, because I know apple cider vinegar is a fermented food. But vinegar in your sauerkraut, does that kill off the bacteria or reduce it?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's where I always am a little bit confused about that.
Yeah. I mean, and vinegar has its own benefits, but mm-hmm. it's not the same as a fermented sauerkraut with no vinegar.
Gotcha.
So yeah.
So we just want to look
for... You want to avoid vinegar. You want something with just salt and cabbage or, and you know, maybe they add onions or garlic and all those things are beneficial too.
Okay.
Yeah, but straight up. And, you know, I always say like the more local you could get, the more small scale producer, you're going to get a better quality ferment. So the best place to pick these things up is often a farmer's market where there's someone producing them. That's better than the grocery store or a health food store. You'll find these more local products. They're always higher quality and better tasting, in my opinion.
Well, and that's one thing I totally agree, but they do get very expensive, right? And of course, we want to support local, but even I know to buy a small little tub of sauerkraut from my local farmer's market, it's like $11.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't need very much, but of course, you know, you can go through that like... I can go through that in 2 days.
Yeah.
So that's why even in our Fitchix Academy Holistic Nutrition Weight Loss Expert Program, one thing we teach is how to make your own probiotic foods.
Yeah.
Because it's so cheap.
Like it literally, saves it's so cheap much money. Yeah.
And if you actually get into the process, it's fun, it's cheap, and you save so much money, and you literally have just created your own medicine cabinet in a sense.
Yeah. And you get much more diversity that way as well, because you're buying different cabbages or different things in different seasons, and you could add different things in there, and which changes up the bacteria profile. And variety, as we already sort of mentioned, is really important for the microbiome.
So, okay. Just staying on that. Okay. We just talked about a few different options first. So we talked about other options for fermented foods, sauerkraut, sourdough, kimchi, kefir, milk kefir, water kefir, kombucha.
Yogurt.
What are some other ones? Yogurt, miso.
Yeah, miso's fermented. Tempeh,
which is a fermented soy. It's like fermented tofu, essentially, isn't
it? It's fermented, compressed fermented soybeans. Yeah. Cheeses are fermented.
Yes, I always forget
all sorts of cheeses, and people forget that cheese can actually be healthy in small amounts.
And then
we have our different, there's all sorts of different cultural ferments as well. We have things like injera, which is the fermented bread from Ethiopia.
Oh, I love that bread.
Tepache, which is a fermented pineapple drink from Mexico. There's curtido, which is like a El Salvadorian fermented sauerkraut. And you can find these things in your community if you seek them out. It's actually fairly easy.
So yeah. Cool. So, okay. We got to talk about the health benefits, though.
Okay.
So what are probiotics? I know that's a hot topic, and a lot of people mm-hmm. are hearing, you know, probiotics in your yogurt, take probiotics, but a lot of people don't even really know what probiotics are.
Yeah. So probiotics are essentially beneficial bacteria. They're found in our body inside and out, you know, from our eyes to our mouth to our stomachs. We even emit a microbial cloud around us.
Oh my God.
Kind of freaks people out.
Yeah, like maybe that's why there's some people that just kind of repel you. You're like, my bacteria doesn't like your bacteria. Get out of my,
cloud. I really actually think that that's a thing.
We should do that on Tinder, like online dating. We should be like, what is your bacterial cloud like? Oh,
no, we're not a match. Maybe Swipe one day up. We'll get there. Maybe one day we'll get there. Yeah. So probiotics are these beneficial bacteria, and they're most known in terms of affecting our health in our digestive tract and what they do in our digestive tract. So they help our body absorb nutrients. They help our body metabolize food. They play a role in the immune system because most of our immune system cells are actually found in our gut. They play a role in regulating our hormones, and they affect our cardiovascular health and then autoimmune disorders as well. So they play a role in all these things. There's actually a blog on my website that people can go to and find out a little bit more about this. It gets into the science, but how the microbiome is linked to all health conditions. And again,
we'll also on our blog, anyone who's listening to this or watching this, mm-hmm. We'll definitely be linking from our website to Corey's website so you can get all this awesome information.
Yeah. So probiotics perform all these sorts of important functions in the body. And, you know, again, it comes back to having the right balance of bacteria, having more good than bad bacteria, as well as the diversity. And I think that's the main benefit with fermented foods. Fermented foods will give you diversity. Whereas, you know, I often get asked, what's the benefit of having fermented foods over a probiotic capsule?
Yeah, that's and a good question.
So one of the key benefits is that you get the more diversity with fermented foods. So 1 teaspoon of milk kefir has about 32 different strains of probiotics. And it also has 50 billion CFUs. CFUs is the measurement, colony-forming units, but it's the measurements of probiotics. So 1 teaspoon has 50 billion CFUs. So when you buy capsules, like 50 billion CFUs is way up in the upper level of the amount you can get per capsule.
And those are expensive.
They're like, really expensive.
Yeah, because typically when you buy probiotics, you'll see 5 billion, you know, 10 billion, and the 50 is like
really high. I think you can get 100 million now, but or you could just eat 2 teaspoons of milk pepper. Right. So, and again, diversity is important because, you know, if you think, you know, a lot of people think of bacteria as being competitive, but they're actually more communal than mm-hmm. anything. So when you have the diversity, you know, like Lactobacillus acidophilus may be the star for this important function, but it's important to have all the other guys there supporting that bacteria and helping it. And then there's a lot of bacteria in these ferments, and we don't even know exactly how they're benefiting the body. But we know that when ferments are eaten as a whole, that they definitely improve people's health.
So that's one thing you actually taught me, because a lot of was about the diversity over time. So for example, when I was making my sauerkraut, I was like, okay, when is the bacteria the best? Like, when is it the most potent? And, you know, is there an ideal time to eat it? Mm-hmm. And I remember what you said, but I'm going to let you explain it, how that, when you should eat it and when it's at its kind of peak by research.
Yeah. So I looked into this extensively, trying to figure out like when are there the most probiotics in your sauerkraut? And I haven't found a really good research study on it. I found one study and it said about 3 weeks is when you get the optimal level of probiotics. But what I think is more important is that you're eating it regularly and consistently, like you're eating it daily. So, you know, some people will wait for the 3 weeks because they think they're getting the optimal probiotics. But, you know, if you don't like the texture after 3 weeks or the taste and you're not going to eat it, then and you prefer it after 1 week, you're still going to get a lot of beneficial bacteria. So eat it after 1 week or eat it after 2 weeks. Or you can wait for the 3 weeks or even longer. After the 3 weeks, it sort of levels out. So you don't have to, you know, you don't have to keep it going. But the most important thing is that people eat it consistently and regularly. And again, there's never been, I haven't come across any research saying exactly how much to eat. But a good guideline, I think, is anywhere between 2 to 4 tablespoons or about 1/4 cup per day of lacto-fermented vegetables is a good place to start.
Well,
and lacto-fermented vegetables includes things like sauerkraut, kimchi, and like lacto-fermented pickles.
Well, and that's one thing I think it makes it sound so doable. Cause I think at first people hear I'm supposed to be eating sauerkraut and they think they're supposed to be eating, you know, cause we kind of still live in this society with the more is better mentality, mm-hmm. but really it's like what you just said, you know, like 1/4 cup throughout the day or 2 tablespoons of milk kefir, which you could easily add into your, or even 1 tablespoon into your smoothie if you don't like the taste of it and not even taste it.
Yeah.
So that to me is super doable.
It's easy to incorporate, like even sauerkraut, like you can mix it into a salad. right?
Or remember when we had that class together, we even had one of the other girls, she made a smoothie with sauerkraut in it that was delicious. You couldn't taste it.
Yeah.
It was delicious. The people were like, what, you put sauerkraut in the smoothie? I'm like, you couldn't even tell it was there.
Yeah. And it's important, you know, and go with something you like too.
Yeah.
Like there's all sorts of ferments out there. So try the different ones and go with what you like the best. That's going to keep you coming back to them, keeping you wanting to make them and being consistent.
And when it comes to probiotic foods though, you know, should we be consistently eating them every day, or is it something that, you know, you can do every 2 days or 3 days? Like, what is kind of the recommendation from your experience?
I say every day.
Yeah.
Start with at least one ferment every day. And ideally you want the lacto-fermented vegetables because there's more probiotics in there. You're also getting prebiotics in those, which we haven't talked about, which is a whole other topic.
I know, we're going to have to do a whole other podcast on prebiotics. We're totally scheduling that too.
Okay, cool. So yeah, I ideally eat that every day. I try to actually go for myself. I go for three different ferments a day, but I'm a little hardcore. So in the morning, I'll wake up and I'll have something like milk, kefir, or yogurt. If you don't do dairy, you could always do like something like a coconut yogurt.
Yeah.
In the afternoon, I'll have a small serving, and I say small, of something like kombucha or water kefir or a fermented drink. You know,
so how much would you drink?
Traditionally, kombucha was drunk in about 4 ounce servings.
Oh, wow.
I think a shot glass is 1 ounce. Yeah. It's not that much. And, you know, I could do a whole other podcast about kombucha as well. But kombucha now, people drink these huge bottles of it, right? Like, like they're even selling them in like 2 gallon bottles. But kombucha contains sugar, it contains caffeine, and it contains a small amount of alcohol. So it's not something, a ferment that I think we should be consuming a lot of.
Well, I remember once I had a bottle of kombucha on an empty stomach and I drank the whole thing. And I remember I felt drunk. Like I was like,
oh yeah.
And I was at a trade show, which made it even worse. So I apologize to anyone who I spoke to after my kombucha experience. But literally I was like, what? And this was before I understood more about fermentation and the process. And I was like, why do I feel like I'm literally buzzed? Like what's
going on? Oh yeah, I can get buzzed off kombucha. I mean, home fermented kombucha often has less alcohol, about 0.5% on average.
Yeah.
But it can vary. And in the US, they've had to pull kombucha off the shelves because it was up to 3%.
Like that's great. And you think a beer, a light beer is 4%. So, you know, that's almost as much as you're drinking a beer.
And then I'll do a lacto ferment in the evening. So my kimchi and sauerkraut and things like that. I mean, the good thing about having something like kimchi and sauerkraut is like you make it once, you make a whole bunch and you put it in the fridge. And so every night you just pull it out and you have this automatic little side dish.
Yeah. And that's what I always found so interesting. I know you love traditional methods and how people like, you know, learning from past cultures and how people used to do things. And we've changed a lot of stuff now, but you know, always when you looked at different cultures, they always served a fermented food on the side. So like, you know, in Poland, they'd have the sauerkraut on the side and, you know, in Korea, it would be the kimchi.
Yeah. And in India, they have the raita, which is like yogurt.
Yeah. And we always kind of thought these things is just, you know, even when you, most North American places, even now they don't give you the real sauerkraut, but you'll get a little coleslaw or something that is like to help with the digestion of the food. But, you know, we kind of lost that practice and it's so, you know, you just need that small little bit to eat along and it just really helps with digestive health.
Yeah, it helps because it contains so many beneficial enzymes. It helps your body digest the rest of the food that you're having your meal with. So
I know that probably people who are listening then, they're probably like, okay, this is great. Well, how the heck do I ferment at home? And we're going to include a recipe from Corey on our blog as well. So you guys can step-by-step learn how to make your own homemade. I think it's kimchi you gave us.
Yes. It's one of my favorite recipes.
I'm going to make it too. Yeah. I've never attempted kimchi. I've done water kefir. I've done kombucha. I've done sauerkraut. I fermented something else. I think I fermented carrots. But I've never done kimchi. So that's my next one.
Well, kimchi is really easy. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm excited. But so just walking through, how would you typically ferment? How long does it take? Kind of that step by step.
Yeah, well, it really depends what you want to ferment, right? Like there's ferments that you could do in a day or two, things like water kefir or milk kefir. Mm-hmm. For people starting out, those two are really easy to do because you're literally just dumping liquid in with what's called grains, even though they're not grains, that's what they're called.
And they're like white bubble, they look like bubble tea, like white bubbly bacteria.
They're actually a SCOBY. So if you've ever made kombucha, they're a type of SCOBY. So those are really easy to do. And that's a good one for people to start off with.
And sorry to interrupt you, just for anyone who's like, well, where the heck do I get these SCOBY from? You can order them online or you can go to a health food store and they'll have them.
Or Kijiji.
Or Kijiji, yeah. Because the thing that's cool, and I didn't know this, well, until my first water kefir, is that the bacteria will start to multiply. So suddenly you start off with this small amount of grains in your water kefir, and next thing you know, you have like, it's like half full, and you have to start a new batch, or you start giving them away.
Yeah.
So that's how I ended up with my first water kefir. I was telling the girl who gave it to me, I'm like, you're like a sperm donor. Like, you're like a water kefir donor. Like, how many little water kefir babies do you have around the city? Because she was just producing so much. And then I started producing more, and you just pay it forward. And that's, again, the cool thing about it. It's part of that symbiotic relationship in the world, is that you are creating something that then you're giving to other people.
Yeah. And I've met so many people just giving them SCOBYs.
Yeah. Like you're like, we became best friends because I gave you a SCOBY. Like, yeah. Which is like the kombucha one is like a gross big bacteria and it grows another one on its back.
I know. Oh, a lady showed up at my workshop and she joked how she was going to give SCOBYs away for Christmas presents.
A gift? I would love
but
that.
Not tell the person what it was.
Oh, okay. That's kind of mean. Traumatized after that. You're like, what is that? It looks like a big portobello mushroom, almost like a soggy.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
So we have our easy ferments, those simple ones like water and milk kefir. So those are good ones to start with. The lacto fermentation process, so your kimchi, sauerkraut, and pickled vegetables, it's a little bit more complicated, but essentially so with sauerkraut, what you do is you chop it up. You could chop up your cabbage. You could use red or white cabbage, doesn't matter, mixture. You could add carrots and onions and things, and then you put salt on it. So about for one head of cabbage, I use about 2 tablespoons of salt.
Which I learned the hard way. The first time I did it, I, for some reason, thought the more salt, the better. I couldn't even eat my sauerkraut.
No,
salty.
You want it, and then you want to start massaging it in, and you want to massage it in. And what the salt will do, it will break down the cell wall and it will draw out moisture from the cabbage. Mm-hmm. So you want to massage this. It takes quite a while, especially if your cabbage is not organic. Because when it's not organic, it's been shipped from far away as dehydrated, basically. When you buy an organic cabbage, it makes all the difference. So you massage it out, and then you draw out the liquid, and you want to be able to squeeze the cabbage so it drips the brine down, right? And so you want it really nice and moist.
Which is also very therapeutic, by the way. For anyone who's ever done it, it's like, you're just, you know, there, and your hands are all dirty. It honestly is, like...
Yeah, you can take out a lot of frustration too. You're just like,
That as well. Yes, that as well.
So you're drying out the moisture and you want to get a nice amount of brine in there, like really nice and moist. And then what you're going to do is you're going to pack the cabbage into a jar. And there's lots of different fermentation vessels. Again, I could do a whole talk just on that. You want to pack, but the easiest one is a jar, right? I call this the jar and jar method. So you pack it into a jar, and you want to pack it into the jar, and you want to get the brine to rise about an inch or two above the cabbage, right? You have a good amount of brine sitting on top. Then what you want to do is you want to take part of a cabbage leaf and shape it so it can fit in the jar, and it's going to kind of keep all the cabbage underneath from floating up. So you want it as a barrier, and then you want the brine sitting on top.
So you want the brine, because this is a question actually my students ask a lot. If the brine is not over the cabbage leaf that's holding everything under the brine, but underneath is under the brine, is it okay just to remove the cabbage leaf and eat it?
No, so I'm not sure I'm understanding your question.
So you know how when you pack it in,
yeah.
So you're packing in all your cabbage, the brine is on top, and then you push in a piece of a cabbage leaf to mm-hmm. essentially keep that chopped up cabbage underneath the brine. What happens if that cabbage leaf, that's the kind of seal, the big one at the top, floats up over the brine?
Well, you don't want it to float up over the brine.
Okay.
So what you want to do is actually put another jar. So that's why I call it the jar and jar method, a smaller jar or like a shot glass inside to keep that barrier cabbage leaf under the brine.
Okay.
You want everything under the brine because what the brine is doing, the salt in it, it's creating an environment that's inhospitable for the bad bacteria to grow, but it's allowing the good bacteria to grow. As soon as it hits oxygen, it's going to switch into another type way of creating energy, and you're going to end up getting mold or things like yeast on there.
Yeah.
So everything under the brine is really important.
And I've seen people too, I love the idea of using the shot glass. I haven't used that. I've seen people too use like a plastic bag with marbles in it.
Yeah.
I've also seen, what else have I seen?
You could use
a jar and jar.
Yeah, you could use if you're working with a larger vessel, you could use a plate because ideally you want something that's not going to leave too much exposure.
Yeah.
So you need to leave some exposure so the carbon dioxide can escape. That's why you never want to seal things. Right.
Gotcha.
If you do seal things, you have to burp them. And anyway, that's, again, going into my other types of fermentation vessels, which is a whole other talk. But in the jar and jar method, you want to have a jar on top of your, inside the other jar that's pretty wide, but still going to let air, the carbon dioxide escape. And then
you still want air. Because I know I'm talking about two different things, I guess, right now. But I know the way that I've always done it is I do it with the jar, cabbage leaf inside, try to make sure it's submerged. If I can't keep it down packed, I'll put another jar in it. Like, but then I just leave it just like that. And then it will get really bubbly. And then I usually burp it after a week, but I don't know if that's right.
Well, if the carbon dioxide has a way of escaping, so if you have a smaller jar inside a bigger jar and the carbon dioxide can escape through the side, you don't need to burp it.
Well, I usually would put the little jar in, and then I would seal the top of the mason jar.
Oh, okay, yeah. So if you're sealing it completely, you do need to burp it in that first week almost daily. I mean, I have to burp some of mine twice a day.
Interesting.
Yeah. So
that helps it from exploding, right?
Yes. Yeah. So for beginners, just to prevent any mistakes, I suggest a jar that is wide enough that it doesn't seal things, but it allows the carbon dioxide to escape out the side.
Gotcha.
And then you cover the whole thing with like a dishcloth and you put a rubber band around it so those little evil fruit flies can't get in there. And you let it ferment. The length of time you let it ferment is up to you. Like, it's going to have the most activity in the first week. It's what I call the awkward teenage years of the ferment because it's bubbly.
I love that point though.
Yeah.
And you know something's
like
happening.
Stinky. Yeah. It's stinky. Like, it's just, there's a lot of activity. So, and then after that first week, it will sort of mellow out and not have as much activity going on in there. And so, you know, you let it ferment for as long, again, 3 weeks is the ideal that I've come across, but if after the first week you really love the taste of it and that's when you're going to eat it the most, then stop it after the first week. And the way you stop it is you just take that small jar out and you just put it in the fridge. Refrigeration doesn't totally stop fermentation, but it slows it down enough that it's not going to, you could seal it without worrying that things are going to explode.
Yeah, like I almost feel like the refrigeration, it's like it puts them to sleep.
Yeah.
Like it's like your water capper, like you put it in the fridge, it like puts it to sleep.
Yeah. They're still metabolizing a bit, but they're like,
exactly. They're like
hibernating.
Sleep. Yeah. They're still alive. There's still function going on, but they're sleeping. They're not out having a party.
Yeah.
So so for the actual place where you like to ferment, do you do it in the kitchen in a dark cupboard? Like, where do you keep your ferments?
Yeah. So I have a fermentation station. So I have like
a little. Of course you do. I'm so jealous.
Yeah. So if you're really into fermenting, I suggest you figure that out. But I have a little kitchen cart and I just have it on a shelf in there. I am the type, I need to keep my ferments where I could see them. so I remember to check on them.
Yeah.
So where you keep them in your kitchen, it does need to be out of direct sunlight. Cooler is better, especially for your lacto-fermented ferments. Some people put it in a cupboard. I would forget about them there.
Yeah.
So one thing I teach in terms of choosing your fermentation vessel and where to put it is, what's your personality type? Right? Are you the type who's on top of things? Are you going to remember to burp something every day or twice a day? Are you going to remember to check in that cupboard every couple of days to see how things are doing? Or are you like me and you're kind of a bit forgetful? And so I need to have it on that kitchen cart so every day I see it, and I also like watching them.
Yeah, so, me too.
Yeah, so that way I could check and see how this one's doing and burp it. And not that they need a lot of checking on, but just it just keeps them top of mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that. Because I think that's one thing that a lot of people get really nervous about when fermenting is that, oh my gosh, you know what I mean? Am I going to do something wrong? Is it safe to eat? Am I going to poison myself? Am I doing this properly? So yeah. I love that, because that's one thing I liked about the way you always taught it. It was very like laissez-faire, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like chill, like don't freak out about it.
No one's ever died from fermentation going wrong, right? Like the biggest danger is actually things exploding.
Well, and that was interesting enough when I went to Spain and I was in Cava country, they were talking about how like to prevent that, because of course those bottles are just bombs ready to go off if they're not treated properly, because the CO2 is so high that, and if one explodes, they all explode. So
yeah. And so, you know, and I think when it comes to fermentation too, and the safety issue, we need to go back to just trusting our ability to smell and to see and look at it and see, you know, is this mold? Like
mold? And if there is mold though, should you throw out the whole batch, or should you, can you just remove the moldy part?
So this is one of these things that's debated in the fermentation world.
I love how every single world has a debate.
Oh yeah. You should see the stuff about sourdough. people get really crazy about their sourdough. But with fermentation and mold, there's some people who say like, if you get a bit of mold on top, like say you have that top barrier cabbage leaf.
Yeah.
You could just take that off and then scrape about 1 to 2 inches of the sauerkraut and remove that and eat everything underneath. And it's fine. I've definitely done it. I mean, I haven't had any issues. I know Sandor Katz, who's sort of the fermentation guru of the world. He is also like, just scrape it off and eat things underneath.
Yeah.
But I read some articles. This wasn't scientific research, but just people writing where mold will send down like little tendrils. Like I know. And so they're invisible and you don't see them, but they're in the ferment. And so that can affect you. I don't know how true that is though. All I know is, I mean, I can eat a sauerkraut that's had mold scraped off and I don't react to it in any way. Maybe it depends on your individual bacterial profile and how able it is to withstand those types of molds or yeast that get in there.
Well, like you were saying, like that's the thing that's so interesting is even, you know, at the very beginning when we were talking and you were talking about your story with overcoming health issues and now how you haven't been on antibiotics for
like 20 years.
I'm the same. And for me, it's like, I feel like my constitution and my gut and I feel like I repel the bad bacteria.
Me
so
too.
I feel like I could do it, but I understand if you're someone who is just getting into this and you're constantly have a low, like you have a weak constitution, you're sick all the time, it might be something you want.
Yeah. Your digestive system's not strong. Like I'm the type two, like now I could travel and a lot of my friends will get sick and I don't get sick.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah. So I think it's just from years of building up my gut and having a good amount of good bacteria that maybe, you know, I'm not sensitive to these other types of yeast or molds or bacteria coming in as much as other people are.
And the thing that's what's great for anyone who's listening or watching this and thinking, oh, well, I'm the person who gets sick all the time, is that you can start today building this back up, you know, just by starting even tomorrow, adding some fermented food into your life. You know, it doesn't, there's no point that where it's too late to start.
No, it's not too late to start. And sometimes it takes time. Like it took me years to get rid of my allergies, but I got rid of them. But I have seen people who start eating ferments and they feel better in a month or two. So it's hard to say, the science just isn't there to know exactly what ferment will act on which condition and which person. It's getting there. We've got a ways to go. But sometimes people can introduce a ferment and it will be like a miracle for them. That's not likely. I don't want to trick people into thinking that they could just start eating fermented food.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's going to cure them. But just to know that it can take anywhere between a month to years to, you know, of eating fermented foods and doing other things to improve them, their health, but you can get there.
But that's why I love fermented foods for a lot of reasons, for weight loss too. And I know a lot of our listeners and for our program, our Holistic Nutrition Weight Loss Expert Program, we focus a lot on talking obviously about weight loss, but really weight loss is about getting the body in balance, right?
Yeah.
And when it comes to, there's so many studies that do show the tie between a healthy gut flora and weight management. So they actually took, I remember this one, they took the bacteria out of heavy mice and transferred the gut bacteria of heavy mice into skinny mice.
Lean mice, yeah.
And the lean mice ended up gaining weight really quickly just from that, having that gut bacteria that was not ideal. So I was like, that is insane.
Yeah, like, I'm going to have a blog coming out about gut health and weight loss. But I mean,
it.
Like if you have too many bad bacteria or yeast, it's going to make you, they want sugar. They're going to make you crave sugar, right? And so that's another thing that's changed for me is my cravings for sugar have gone way down.
Well, and that's a question I get asked so much by people is how do I reduce my sugar cravings? And thinking about it from the perspective of like, there's so many little bacteria in there that are like, they feed off sugar. Any bacteria feeds off sugar, right?
Mm-hmm.
Cancer feeds off sugar.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's obviously if you start taking it back to listening to your body, and I mean, there's a lot of other reasons that could play into it, but if you start to listen to your body, you start to understand this. That's why I think knowledge, I think learning about this stuff is so important than just following the next diet. Like learn how your body works and then you'll look at it and approach it from a different way.
Yeah. And you'll realize why everybody's body is a bit different.
Exactly. And why there's no one size fits all. Like
yeah,
when it comes to weight loss plans, people are so like, I want to do the keto diet, which just to let you guys know, if you are on keto, fermented foods are amazing for keto because they're keto approved. But you know, they just want to do the next diet, but it's like that diet someone could thrive on and it could be somebody else's poison.
Yeah,
it's like
it all comes down to your microbiotic profile.
Right? Yeah, which how do you find out your microbiotic profile?
They have tests available, but none of them are very good.
Yeah.
The science is lacking, and our microbiotic profile in our digestive system is constantly shifting. It's, you know, there's no flat line of it. Like, so one day you might have more type of bacteria than another day. It depends what you ate. It also, you know, it depends on the ferments you ate, but also the prebiotic foods you ate. And
it also depends where you live, tap water, stress, alcohol.
Yeah, there's so many variables, but it does shift day to day. The testing is evolving, but I think we have a few more years for that. But I think, you know, in terms of where the research is going, it's going towards what bacteria profile do people have who have this condition versus this condition, or, you know, have trouble losing weight versus people who stay thin. And it's so diverse that it's really hard to measure because we're each individuals. We each have our own history. Our history affects our microbial, how our types of microbes and how much we have. And so there's just so many variables in that, but that's why it's important to not make assumptions about diets, right?
Yeah.
And not say like, oh, the paleo is the way to go, or it's all keto or nothing. You know, it's just to actually test the foods out on yourself and see how they make you feel. It sounds so simple, but it's
I know.
And even with fermented foods, don't make assumptions. Like I have a really hard time digesting tempeh still.
Me too. Me too. Any soy products my body is not happy with.
Yeah. And all that means is my body doesn't have the right bacteria, or it's the type of bacteria and yeast that I have, and I can't digest it well. Doesn't mean that I will always have trouble, because maybe my bacteria profile will shift. So I'm just going to keep testing it and test the foods and that test them, see how you react, and don't just take out foods willy-nilly. Diversity and variety is the spice of life. If we look at any natural system, like a natural ecosystem, they thrive off of diversity. So we want to have diversity in our diet.
Definitely. Right?
And that includes, so that means not excluding foods just for the sake of excluding them because you heard they were bad. That's one aspect. Another aspect is having a variety of different types of fermented foods in your diet if you can. So having, you know, a fermented drink every day and a lacto-fermented food. So just the more variety in a natural system, the more healthy and resilient it tends to be.
And
whether
then
it's an ecosystem or your body, like a forest or your body.
Okay, so we're going to start to wrap this up. I could talk to you all day.
I know.
Honestly.
I'm talking so much.
No, I love it. And I know our listeners will love it. And also, I already have ideas for 3 more podcasts we're going to talk about. But for someone who is listening to this and being like, yes, I am ready to start fermenting, what would be kind of your top 3 tips to set them up so they can kind of take from this podcast and get into action?
Yeah. My first tip is to ferment something you're going to eat.
Oh, yeah.
So, so don't ferment lacto-fermented vegetables just because I said that they're the best one. Or don't ferment, you know, kombucha because you heard it's the best one. Like, what do you like? Because that's going to keep you doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, what's practical in your life? Like, are you a fermenter who likes to just... Are someone who, when you prepare food, you like to just do one big batch of things and let it sit? Or are you someone who likes to prepare a little something day by day? Do you like a quick turnaround time on your ferment? It's just something to consider. The second tip is to just do it. Because trust me, like, I have made every mistake in the book. And, you know, the amount you actually screw up is very little. You know, when
I got over the fear, I was like, whoa, this is a lot easier than I thought.
Yeah, just get out and do it. And you're only going to learn from the mistakes you make.
Mm-hmm.
So just keep trying and don't give up. And I guess that's my last tip is don't give up. If you do, you have a first couple bad batches of things or you're not quite getting it, just do more research, come back to it, and just keep trying it. And you'll get there.
And to get some great, obviously, like I said earlier, we've got a recipe from Corey and instructions how to do it. It's going to be on our website, but also you can go to radicalhealth.ca. And then on her blog, you also have some great stuff too there, right?
Yeah, I do. I don't have necessarily a lot of fermented food recipes there right now, but I do have a lot of recipes, especially on prebiotic foods.
Awesome.
But I plan to get more recipes up there on fermented foods. And I'm also on Facebook and Instagram. I actually probably post more on there than my own website. I keep having technical issues with my website. So you'll get a lot more.
Websites are dead. Don't even worry about it.
Yeah. You'll get a lot more recipes if you join my Instagram or my Facebook page, which is just Radical Health.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. So the last thing I want to ask you, we've covered so much ground today and I love every moment of it. This is kind of a question though, that's like, it could be about fermentation. It could be about nutrition. It could be about anything.
Okay.
But I just want to know, I always like to ask at the end of an interview, especially because I have the awesome opportunity to meet so many incredible women who are working throughout the health industry. So whether it's fitness, nutrition, wellness, and I always like to hear what your one piece of life advice would be. And this could be about your craft or not, but that would help other women live fiercer, happier, healthier. What would that be?
It's to just keep putting your best foot forward. And this is especially true in terms of health. Like, you know, our current food system is sort of designed to make us fail. There's temptation everywhere. There's advertising. And it's hard to eat healthy and be healthy in this society. There's even a lot of peer pressure, right, to eat unhealthy. Like, oh, let's go for pizza, nachos. So if you make mistakes, if you have slip-ups, if things don't go right the first time, if your ferment doesn't work, just keep going. Just, you know, every day, you know, you make your bed, you lie in it, you could just make your bed again, right? Like, just,
yeah,
like, don't think just because you've screwed up that is the end of the road and you can't do anything about it. Just wake up the next day and start anew. Just keep going. One day at a time.
I love it. Yeah. Well, Corey, thank you so much for being with us today. Yeah. Like I said, we are scheduling some more talks because
okay, we could have talked forever.
Oh my gosh. And I know I'm personally a superfood nerd like you are as well, but I think that the more we talk about this and the more we get this information out into like the mainstream, because I think a lot of it is intimidation or feeling like, you know, you have to be doing everything perfect or you have to be a certain type of person to ferment. And it's so not true. This is for everybody. And I think we should start the fermentation revolution, making your own probiotic foods.
Yeah. Well, you really got me thinking more in the direction, like, this is what I need to talking yes. to you during this interview. I'm like, yes, I am really passionate about this more than anything. So I do think I need to stick to the fermentation aspect of everything I want to do.
Well, this thing, and you're such a brilliant person, like when you're talking about herbs and even talking about nutrition and all this stuff, you're such a wealth of knowledge, and whatever you do, anyone's lucky to work with you. So thank you so much for being on here today. And for anyone who's listening, of course, you can get more information on any of our programs. We talked about our Holistic Nutrition and Weight Loss Expert Program at fitchicksacademy.com. We also will have this interview and video. If you're listening to this, you can watch the video and see Corey's beautiful face is on our blog. And we also are going to have links to that recipe and all of Corey's social media, so you can hop on over and get more involved in fermenting and learn from the best.
Hey.
Okay, guys, have an amazing day and thank you. I'll talk to you soon, Corey.
Thank you, Laura.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Fit Chicks Chat Podcast. Want more healthy love? Visit www.fitchicks.com for amazing resources, free workouts, recipes, tips, and so much more to help you live your healthiest and fiercest life, inside and out.